My name is Charles Coutillo of the Royal Historical Society, and today I'm interviewing Professor William Pope on behalf of New Books Network, the History Division.
The subject of our conversation will be Professor Pope's new book, Crusade and Jihad, The Thousand-Year War Between the Muslim World and the Global North. Professor Pope, you have had a most extraordinary career, and I thought before we just got into the book, you could perhaps relate to the audience a bit about your career and indeed discuss some of the individuals who you discuss in the book who you met in person.
All right, sure. Well, I grew up partly on a ranch in Texas, and when I was a very young boy, I was a cowboy, so I started out among other things, riding the fences on my father's ranch. And one of the things I think led me toward the writing of this book was that I knew so little about any of the people who lived around us or who had lived around us before I was born. Just 50 or so years before I was born, the area that I was riding and the fences that my father and his father had built on this land, it of course didn't exist. The area was the preserve of the Comanche Indian people. And as a boy, all I really knew about the Indians were that we regarded them as terrible terrorists, and we were protected by the Texas Rangers and the 7th Cavalry. Otherwise, they would have scalped us and would have horribly mistreated us. We knew almost nothing about their culture, or indeed, we didn't even know their proper name. And none of the people I knew around me did either. And of course, the same is also really true of the Afro-American community. They were just people who, as a boy, I thought were there. They were not part of the community of which I was a part. And they were just a sort of alien presence that somehow loomed over my part of the society. And as I grew a bit older, I went through a period of military training, and then I began to travel around the world. And a very odd thing happened to me during that early period. Everywhere I went, people welcomed me in to their houses, their villages, their tribes. They fed me and took care of me and sped me on my way. It never occurred to me that this was a dangerous situation or that I might be ill-treated. And certainly everywhere I was treated with warmth and friendship and openness, it was quite astonishing. As I grew older and began to study more, I realized, this is of course after World War II, that many of the people in the world had begun to change their feelings strongly about America and Americans. And as I began to be able to read their language or languages and to talk to more and more people, I realized that it was much about what we were doing in the world and what was happening around me that I simply knew nothing about. So I delved as deeply as I possibly could into particularly Arabic and Turkish, and began to study and teach the cultures and habits and fears and hopes of peoples all over Africa and Asia in several American universities. Then I went into the government during the Kennedy administration, and at the request of the president, was put in charge of planning American policy for much of Africa and Western and Central and South Asia. And during the course of that time, I had the marvelous experience of traveling a great deal, meeting a lot of people, talking to virtually all the major leaders and the and their opponents in many cases, all over that vast area. It really was sort of like going back to school all over again. It was a marvelous experience. I learned a great deal from it. And I resigned not quite a year after President Kennedy's death. During that period, I had also played a rather significant role in the Cuban Missile Crisis and was one of the three members of organization that was called the Crisis Management Committee. So when I left the government, I went to become professor of history at the University of Chicago. And during that time, I wrote a number of books and lots of articles. And then in 1967, I set up and became the director and later president of the Attlee Stevenson Institute of International Affairs. Then a few years later, 8 years later, in fact, I resigned and settled down to do most of the writing I've done ever since. But I've had the opportunity to meet and talk with virtually an astonishing array of the people who thought and worried about the position of American world affairs. And this book really is a kind of culmination of some 70 years of research, thinking, writing, talking, and visiting people all over this vast area. So it's a sort of distillation, in effect, of my life, as well as my reaction to and learning from the various people I've dealt with. So that in a capsule is pretty much the background of the book and where I've come from.
Now, what would you say is your primary thesis or idea of your book?
The primary notion is that we, or the motivation, if you will, is that we know so little about most of the people who we're dealing with in the world. We have enormous power, but we have also enormous ignorance. The number of Americans who can find other countries on a map is astonishingly low. Even the people who are many of the people who we've appointed as ambassadors to represent the United States show absolutely appalling ignorance about the world we live in. And my thesis, I suppose, is that if we want to have peace, and if we even want to have a modest amount of security, we've got to know more about what the other people we have to live with want and what they're doing and how we can get along with them. If we don't have that, we don't have, it seems to me, much of a chance of having the security and peace that we all want. That's the motivation behind the book.
In your introduction, you highlight the importance of the Arabic language in relating your story. Can you perhaps expand on that a little bit?
Well, yes. Arabic is one of the world's major languages. It, along with English and Russian and Chinese, is spoken by a large part of the world population. And Arabic encapsulates the culture of the Muslim world. Even those people who speak other languages as their preferred or home language learn Arabic because the principal religious document, the Quran, is written in Arabic. And most of the elevated or sophisticated studies of not only religion, but religion as politics and as culture is encapsulated in Arabic. Arabic, Turkish, and Persian are the major languages that are used over this vast area where something like one out of every six people in the world is a member of that community. So it's the ability to listen to what other people are saying, to read what they're writing, is absolutely critical in an attempt to understand what the world that we have to live in is made up of. And if we don't begin to have that, then it's really an astonishing weakness on our side. Think how odd it would seem to you or to me to have somebody come to the United States to write about our politics and our history and our people's attitudes and so forth, who was illiterate in English, who was unable to communicate with anybody in our language. We would think that's really absolutely absurd. But until roughly the 1960s, we relied on, in quotes, experts who were simply illiterate in the languages and the background of the people who we were trying to deal with or trying to understand.
Yes, although I suppose if one wanted to be contrary, one could point out that, say, someone like, I don't think you've met them, they were a little bit before your time, but you've probably heard of them, like Gertrude Bell or Sir Arnold Wilson, who were thoroughly familiar with the culture and background, the language of the peoples of Mesopotamia and further afield in the near Middle East, but that didn't necessarily make their policies vis-a-vis the local people any more enlightened.
Well, there were a few, but you're quite right, Gertrude Bell and a handful of others, but most of them, in fact, really knew just the superficial aspects of the language they were dealing with. They couldn't read, most of them couldn't read the language. They could, quite a few of them spoke what often was called kitchen Arabic. And they were also not particularly concerned with trying to understand what the people they were dealing with wanted or thought about or how they were formed. But they were concerned with how they could be controlled by the imperial powers. Gertrude Bell, for example, who you mentioned, was the senior local expert on Iraq during the great time of rebellion against the British. And her interest in Iraq was, of course, how to help the British control the country.
Yeah, so in essence, her interest was not that of the local people's primary interest, but of her own government's. But that's in perhaps the nature of things. But getting back to your introduction of the book, can you highlight, could you actually explain a little bit, because you go into it, the dynamism or the impetus, if you like, of the military expansionism of Islam from the death of Muhammad to, say, the latter part of the 7th century?
Yes. What happened was quite an extraordinary thing, and it's not only in that period of history, but also during the Mongol invasions and the Turkish invasions later in Central Asia. Tribal people tend to split up among themselves, so they balance one tribal group against another, and the net result is very little outside pressure. What happened in Islam was that Muhammad managed to convince a number of the tribal leaders with whom he dealt, and the city and town leaders who he enrolled in his activities, that they should join together in what became a kind of super tribe, the tribe of Islam. And he outlawed internal fighting, not always successfully, but with some reasonable success, so that all the energies that had been devoted against one another within the society of Arabia were suddenly turned outward. And that was a time in which the peoples of Europe and North Africa were themselves divided into various groups. And the Persian Empire, the Iranian Empire, was itself in a period of turmoil, if not chaos. So that the sudden explosion of military force, which had previously been divided and neutralized internally, erupted against this sequence of people. And so Islam, originally the Muslims, and then followed later by the Berbers and the Turks and other people who converted to Islam, as I say, exploded against the Iranian Empire, the Byzantine Empire, and on into parts of Europe. It was a period of great conquest, but much of it, it was not so much a military conquest as such, because almost everywhere local peoples joined with the Muslims for various reasons. For example, in Spain, it was to a large extent the Jewish community which had been persecuted under the Vandal regime that welcomed the Berber invasion of Spain and converted much of Spain into an Islamic state, or an Islamic caliphate, as it became. That happened also in Iran. There was a large part of the Iranian population which was essentially politically neutral, or had been as much exploited by their own governments as they later would be exploited by the incoming Arabs. So everywhere, that's a similar set of opportunities arose. And even before the invasions per se, and of course always after it, various peoples gained a great deal from trade, from the unification of areas, the opening of new lines of communication, so that even with the disruption of things like the Crusades, the whole of the Mediterranean world became virtually a free trade area. And there was an effusion of culture in the aftermath of this period of invasion that was astonishing to the Europeans. Europe was at that time in the depths of the Dark Ages, after the collapse of the Roman Empire and the invasion of the Mongol, of the Vandals, and the various other tribal groups who overthrew the Roman Empire. What occurred in the Muslim areas was the light that shone in that dark period.
Yes, I take it then you would not agree with people like Dario Fernandez Moreno in his book, The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, that in fact the amalgamation of the three groups of people, Christian, Jewish, and Muslims, in Spain was more of a myth than a reality, and that there was more of a case of Muslim heavy predominance?
I don't want to get into an argument on somebody else's interpretation of these things, but I think if you look at the production of literary texts, the research in medicine and astronomy, the cultural effusion in literature and so forth, this Spain became a sort of ecumenical society. Much of it was done by Arabs, a lot of it by Berbers, some of it by the resident Jewish community, a lot of it by various immigrants from other areas. But given the context that we're dealing with at the time of the Dark Ages in Europe, it was an astonishing cultural achievement. And whether one group played a larger role than another is, of course, open always to revision and doubt and so forth. But on balance, it was it was something that absolutely mesmerized the contemporary society.
Would you agree with those historians who posit that Muslim civilization was fundamentally changed by the Mongol invasions and their aftermath in the 13th and 14th centuries?
Oh, enormously so, yes. What happened is I think, not so well known as it should be. The Mongol invasion went over quite a long period of time and stretched over an enormous extent of the world's territory. So that, of course, it changed from time to time, and the impact that it had on different peoples changed. But, for example, take one little area, Kashmir. The Mongol invasion virtually wiped out the previous largely Hindu culture of Kashmir. And what happened was that the Kashmiris went, in effect, aside from their own inherited background and began to try to find something new and different to protect their lives and to give them some hope in the future. The same thing happened over much of Central Asia and ultimately throughout practically the entire band that stretches around the earth from east to west. That factor was the rise of mysticism or Sufism. What happened very simply was that people over a period of almost a century found that their lives had disintegrated into a virtual collapse. It was what I would imagine might happen in the world if we had a nuclear war. People were killed in the millions. People who survived were barely hanging on to the threads of their previous life. And the attraction of mysticism was that all that really didn't matter. That if you deeply believed and you did certain things to enhance your sensitivity to your inner self, you could survive. And that movement, which came to be called Sufism, spread everywhere. And so we find groups of Sufis forming brotherhoods in the Sudan, in Morocco, in Arabia, in Chinese Turkestan, in everywhere that one can touch, all through that huge expanse of territory across the world.
In the book, you state that in between the 16th and the 18th centuries, what you characterize as, quote, the global north, unquote, became more advanced and more expansionist than the global south, as you also term it, or aka, in the context of this book, Arabic Muslim civilizations. Why was that?
Well, I think there were multiple reasons. One reason was that for all the bad things that the Mongol invasion did, it opened up the world in surprising ways. We see, for example, that people like Marco Polo were able for the first, not the only time, but for virtually the first time, to travel the world fairly easily. The Polo brothers and Marco went to China, and they brought back various things that they had learned there. The Chinese civilization had bloomed in the meantime, even under Mongol rule. And so all of a sudden, Europeans began to take tentative small steps toward what we saw happening in the Industrial Revolution and later. For example, the first coins were minted in the 13th century, and so for the first time, commerce became much more easy than it had been for 500 or 600 years in Europe. The first gold coin, in fact, was minted in Florence, and it was patterned on a Chinese use of currency. Then later, one by one, various small steps began to be taken. One that's fascinating to me is that the eyeglasses were invented. And what that did was to enable a craftsman who had spent his whole life learning how to do some piece of work was apt to be at the age of 40 or 45 or 50, no longer capable of doing his job. But the invention of eyeglasses gave him another period of 5 or 10 or 20 years to do more work. So that if you think of it in statistical economic terms, the labor force, the skilled labor force of Europe, over a period of nearly a century, was given something like a 25% boost in productivity. As paper became available and as printing presses began to be set up, originally, most of them in Europe as well as in the Muslim world were devoted to religious topics. But little by little, they began to change and to talk about how you could, for example, build a windmill. And as they learned how to embed in a book an illustration of the a picture or a drawing of a windmill could be inserted to show how you built it. So little by step, various things happened that enabled the Europeans to move ahead. And in the case of trade, the opening of the Mediterranean to international trade was another major factor. There was much more movement back and forth along the Mediterranean coast than most of us even knew about 50 years ago. So that there was a great deal of intercultural activity that also stimulated Europe. Then finally, as the Europeans developed more military technology and more capacity to operate, they struck out across the Mediterranean into Africa particularly. The Europeans at that time also developed a taste for sugar, and sugar spread, or the growth of sugar spread slowly from the eastern Mediterranean to the Atlantic. And sugar plantations required an enormous amount of labor. And that's what caused the Europeans to begin the process of colonization of Africa, particularly the rise of the slave trade. It was interesting that it was Columbus's stepfather who ran one of the sugar plantations in the Azores, which was his stopping off place on the way to the New World. And there was much interest in massive crop development of that period. That led on to the later policies of European powers as they became more and more adept at handling the Asians to build the capacity to run Asian countries. And as they did, that got them little by little into what we call the Industrial Revolution. And a major factor of the Industrial Revolution that is very rarely mentioned is that much of the financing for it actually came from Africa and Asia. And while the beneficiaries were primarily the English and to some extent the French, much of the money that enabled the Industrial Revolution to get underway was produced in India. And as the Europeans developed their capacity in finance and trade, they bought, for example, the trade and industrial development of Egypt in order to open it up to European goods. So the whole series of little steps, one after another, culminated in the enormous growth of power of what I call the North. In the South, those things didn't happen in the same way. When you had almost unlimited manpower, as say the Indian government in the Mughal Empire had, you didn't really need to do things that saved labor. So people did not engage in building equipment that was a labor-saving device. If you had an elephant to ride, you didn't need to have a carriage. And if you didn't have a carriage, you didn't need to build a road. And so step piece by piece, these things all impacted on one another to the advantage of Europe and the disadvantage of the South countries.
In the book, you appear to shortchange a bit the Arabic or Near Eastern, if you like, involvement in the slave trade, which was quite longstanding, both the slave trade from the Caucasus as well as what is today Crimea, southern Ukraine, as well as, of course, the slave trade from sub-Saharan Africa. Why is that?
I don't mean to shortchange that in any sense at all. It was a multinational activity in which everybody was involved, and everybody enjoyed slavery for a long period of time. The original slaving expeditions in starting in Africa relied heavily on local African chiefs having a war with their neighbors and enslaving the people and selling them to the Europeans who bought them. Slavers operated in East Africa in the same way, enslaving their enemies and military defeated societies and selling them to Arab and other slave traders. Arab slave traders were quite predominant in the Caucasus and in Russia. A large part of the slave trade was in the hands of Jewish merchants, so that you had Christian, Jewish, Muslim involvement in the trade, along with the active involvement of local peoples who were neither one of those three religions.
And isn't it also the case that until the late 50s, early 1960s, there was still some type of slavery enforced in Arabia, in the Gulf states?
Yes, there's no question that I think the UN statistics indicate an almost unbelievable number of millions of people today who we would classify as slaves. All over, not only in Arabia, but in a very wide sweep of the world. And of course, even after slavery was legally abolished in other countries, say India, for example, a sort of subterfuge was created, which was virtual slavery, in which so-called indentured laborers were recruited because they were starving to death, and shipped abroad to work in rubber plantations and tin mines and various groups that ended up in the Caribbean and all over much of the Western world. Slavery is a horrible thing, but it's something that all of us have rather dirty hands in dealing with.
Could you explain to the audience the historical importance for the region of Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in 1798?
To understand why Napoleon invaded?
No, the historical importance in terms of the reaction, local reaction to his invasion and occupation of Egypt.
I think the local reaction was really probably much exaggerated. We know that the Egyptians disliked the French as foreigners, and the French committed a lot of, as armies almost always do, of atrocities, so that there was a reaction against them, but not, I think, in the sense that has so often been written, particularly by French writers, that Napoleon cast suddenly light into darkest Africa, and the Africans went ahead to produce their reaction to the modern world in the light of what he had done. The period after Napoleon was a period in which the Ottoman Empire or its minions returned and resuscitated their control over Egypt. They got rid of the traditional slave of rulers, the Mamluks, and began to create what they thought was a modern European army. Particularly, the Ottoman Empire was doing the same thing at the same time. It was a long time before very much of what we think of as Egypt was really influenced deeply by anything that resembled European culture. There were fascinating exceptions, of course, to that. There were intellectual Egyptians, such as the writer who we read most about, who had visited Europe and wrote a book on France, number of people who were involved in that kind of transformation were always, relative to Egyptian society, very small for at least another generation.
Can you relate to the audience the origins of Arab nationalism in the late 19th century and why in the 20th century in essence failed as a political project?
Nationalism.
Specifically Arab nationalism.
Nationalism spread in Europe, of course, much earlier than in the southern part of the world. It began to be thought of, I suppose, most generally as an aftermath of the French Revolution. And captured the imagination of the German, little German principalities, the little Italian principalities, and had already captured the imagination of the French. So other people began to discover it during the 19th century. For the first time, I think it's fair to say the Jewish community discovered nationalism in the middle of the 19th century. And the Arabs were much slower. They didn't really pick up the notion of nationalism until the 20th century. And then it was a way to get over the issue of religion. Christians could not join easily with Muslims in a political movement. But if the movement were rechristened as nationalism, it was possible for both Muslims and Jews and Arabs to join together, which increasing numbers of them did, particularly in Lebanon, to some extent in Egypt, and then little by little in various other countries. But it was a movement that has to be thought of, I think, both in terms of its positive aspects, that it got people together, and its negative aspects in that it overwhelmed the forces of division between them.
You describe the writer who subsequently called himself Al-Afghani as the political missionary of 19th century, of the political missionary of the 19th century Muslim world. Can you tell the audience a little bit about him and why he's an important figure in your story?
Yes, he's an absolutely fascinating figure. We all love to think of history in terms of personalities, of course, and it makes it much more interesting and much more humane and human to us. And he was an extraordinary man and under any definition. He probably was born in Iran. And the importance of that was that he probably was originally, if not overtly, or if not covertly, always a Shia Muslim rather than a Sunni Muslim. And his adoption of the name Al-Afghani was probably a way of disguising the fact that he did have this Shia background. He started out in really the first time that we know much of anything about him in Afghanistan. He was a wandering scholar. I don't know how one can say how deeply religious person he was, but he was certainly very learned in the field of Islam and Islamic subjects. And he actually acted as an advisor on political matters to the then rulers of Afghanistan. They fell out under terms we don't know very much about, and he ended up traveling to India, where he lived apparently very quietly for a period of time. What he did, nobody knows. He then made his way across to Arabia in the guise of performing the pilgrimage, which he may have been totally in favor of doing, or even emotionally in favor of doing. But he then traveled on to Egypt, and where he fell into small group of young Egyptians who were desperately trying to figure out what had gone wrong in their lives, what they needed to do to reclaim what they thought of as the vigor and importance of their way of life, as they cast it in terms of religion. And he particularly was very close to a man by the name of Muhammad Abdu, who became his right-hand man, his secretary and helper and so forth, and with whom he later founded a journal that was read all over Asia and Africa, espousing the cause of modernizing Islam. He then decided that the way to reform that part of the world was not so much in intellectual terms, but in going to the leaders of the world, of the Muslim world. So he tried to convert to his way of thinking both the Shah of Iran and the leader of the Ottoman Empire, neither one of which was successful. They both regarded him as a subversive character and wanted to get rid of him. He probably was involved in an act of political terrorism and assassination. And he led a, if you will, a frustrating course of his career from one seeming opportunity to another. But what he finally left behind him was a residue of thinking about the possibility of a reform of Islam that motivated a whole generation of thinkers, not only in Egypt and in the Middle East, but also in the Caucasus and the southern Russia and in the Crimea and all throughout Central Asia.
One of the figures that you meet in the book personally is the late President Nasser of Egypt. Can you tell us a little bit about the context of your meeting and why ultimately his political project of, or his particular type of Arab nationalism failed as a political project?
Nasser was an extraordinary figure, very, very different, of course, from the man we've just been talking about, Jamal ad-Din. Nasser was a young officer in the Egyptian army who had seen the corruption of the Egyptian government up close. As a military officer, he fought in the campaign in Palestine, and he came back, I wouldn't say embittered, but determined that something had to change if dignity, which was a major force all through his life, was to be obtained. And I think he went into politics without any very strong preconceived ideas. He was always questing for ideas, and everyone he talked to, he queried about what their opinions were. I had a number of talks with him in which he was extraordinarily frank and straightforward about what he was trying to do. What he was trying to do, basically, was to upgrade the population of his country of Egypt. That was his first objective. And the way to do that, he thought, was through education. But he realized that he couldn't do very much with education as it then existed in Egypt, because that was all through, in the first place, through the humanities. And he wanted things that were, in his terms, practical. He wanted technology in science. And also because the educational system of Egypt fell into two parts. One was religious, which didn't seem to him to contribute anything to the goals that he'd set. And the other was that it was restricted essentially to the privileged class. The people who went, for example, to the University of Cairo were almost all from the privileged urban group, not from the people who lived in the villages where most Egyptians lived. So what he hit on was the idea, first of all, of inducting into the army a large part of the Egyptian population. And during their period in the army, giving them a modicum of technological capacity. The first thing, for example, was a large number of young men learned how to drive a car, or learned how to drive a truck or a tank or an armored car. They had never had any kind of experience of that kind before. They had to have people who knew how to repair those things. They, little by little, were transformed by the knowledge of what life in the villages had done to them. Because one of the terrible facts of life in most of Africa and a large part of Asia was that there is, in the waterways of the Nile and the various other rivers, a worm disease that's carried by snails called bilharziosis. And if you wade in the water, which you have to do to engage in agriculture, you become infected with bilharziosis almost definitely, almost assuredly. And if that happens, you are killed. It's not a mass murderer like malaria, for example, but it does result in a loss of vigor and capacity. People who have bilharziosis are tired all the time. Their energies are sapped. Their motivation is undermined. And he recognized that these people had to be, as it were, yanked out of the river valleys and brought into the cities. And so the army was his school. And he created what I have called, in another context, new men. They were people who learned how to use mechanical tools. They learned how to do various things. For example, a man who learned how to use an electric saw was suddenly a Western-style carpenter, and very different from the traditional carpenter that existed in the society. And those people came to play a major role in what he was trying to do by industrializing the country. He then, ironically and curiously, tried to adapt the Israeli system of the kibbutz to Egyptian society, creating a province of Egypt in which all the members were vetted psychologically before being allowed in. Their dress was changed. Their children were put in special schools. They were had their standard of living artificially upgraded, and they were to be the new Egyptians. The program did not work very well. He had no major capacity to undertake it. Egypt was a poor country, and even the resources that he had commanded were relatively small. If it had been otherwise, if he'd had the money, the people, and so forth to do it, you might have seen today a very different Egypt. But the old Egypt continued and overwhelmed, in effect, the new Egypt that he was trying to create. He was driven as a consequence of his ideas into activities abroad. We in the American government often tried to get him to stop diddling with other countries, stop engaging in trying to force their governments into his way of thinking. And Yemen was his Vietnam. It really destroyed what he was trying to do. And toward the end of his life, of course, the whole system virtually collapsed. And he died in 1970. One of the last things he did was to agree with for a ceasefire on the Suez Canal with Israel. And he had already indicated before that time his willingness to stop the Arab-Israeli, or stop at least the Egyptian-Israeli war, by agreeing to some of the things that we were trying to push him to do, demilitarizing Suez, allowing ships free passage in the Enterprise Canal, or channel to the south of Israel, and to work toward a recognition of Israel. At the end of his life, I think it's fair to say that his notion of Arab unity and Arab nationalism had collapsed.
Where would you fit in your story? Where do you fit, I should say, in your story, Osama bin Laden?
Say that again.
Where do you fit in your story, Osama bin Laden?
Osama bin Laden, I take, is in effect the next generation. What happened as the collapse of nationalism at the end of Nasser's life was that everyone who had thought that there was something in nationalism that would give them the sense of meaning, protection, dignity, and so forth that they were seeking, it didn't work. The only thing they really had left was religion. And Osama bin Laden, for anything that one thinks about him, was a deeply religious man. And he picked up the ideas of the Egyptian leader of the Islamic movement under the Muslim Brotherhood, and carried it into militancy. That was, it seems to me, an almost inevitable move. He was, I never met him, but he was a man who was curiously adept at transforming his activities to fit his ideology. For example, one of the things that was quite astonishing about him was that when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, Osama bin Laden offered to raise a military force to help drive him out. And he despised Saddam Hussein because he was not because he was a tyrant, but because he was a secularist. And the mood that that we associate with Osama bin Laden was a move back toward the only thing that the people who were fighting against the residues of colonialism and imperialism, what I call the post-colonial malaise, had left was religion. And he was the personification of that movement.
Professor Polk, if you wanted a reader to take away one thing from your book, what would it be?
I think what I would like to have him do is read the final section, which has three parts. The first part is what we did to that part of the world and what that part of the world did to themselves. And finally, then, what I think we could begin to do to create the sense of security and peace and well-being that we all hope for. The message of the book is, what has happened in the past was terrible. We've got to find a way to get over it, to move toward the future. And the only way that we can start that process is by a full understanding of what really did happen in the past and to what extent we were responsible for it. If we can face up to that, then I think we can put together the elements that will enable us to move toward the freedom, the security, the decency, the well-being that all of us look for.
Professor Polk, I would like to thank you very much for speaking to us today. It's been a pleasure as well as an enlightening experience.
Thank you so much indeed. It's been a delight talking to you.
Thank you. This is Charles Cutillo, New Books Network. We've been speaking to Professor William Polk on his new book, Crusade and Jihad, Yale University Press. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, sir.